You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
It's Wednesday, so it's time for Wayne on Wednesday. Wayne McCurry is a portfolio manager at FNB Wealth and Investment in Johannesburg. Now, Wayne, I thought about you over the last few days because I thought we've seen it all before, you and I, what we've just endured over the last few days. But there must be some youngsters sitting on a desk, you know, in their late 20s or mid or late 20s or something that have never seen this type of activity. But we've seen it before, and presumably we know the outcome, and the outcome is playing out right now. In other words, it was a moment in time.
Lindsay, I actually fundamentally agree with you on that. You know, obviously when things like this happen, no matter how many times you've experienced it before, always scary. Now, no matter how many times, how many years you've been in the market, it's always scary. So now I think there's two or three factors to discuss here.
Okay.
The first is the reason and then the trigger. The reason why a lot of these stocks came off is that they were just expensive. They had just run too hard, too fast.
Yeah.
The trigger was the jobs report and all the worries about the U.S. economy and the economic slowdown and company results showing a bleak consumer environment, etc. People always think the reason why the stocks fell was because of the jobs report. That's actually wrong. The reason why they fell is they were just expensive. The jobs report was the trigger that caused them to fall on that day. So those are the first two points. Other points are we are highly unlikely to get a fully blown bear market on the cusp of interest rate cuts. Just doesn't happen when interest rates are about to be slashed. Because even though the economy is doing poorly, when interest rates come down, the economy recovers. So there's no danger to earnings in the medium term, or there's no danger to the economy in the medium term because interest rates aren't going up, they're going down. So, you know, whatever's happened, I don't know if it's over, I don't know, but whatever's happening, it's just a correction. This is not the start of a bear market. Bear markets start when the outlook is higher, interest rates are going up, inflation going up, et cetera, et cetera. That's the trigger, and overvaluation of the market. That's the trigger for a bear market. So we've got the overvaluation, even though it's 10% lower than what it was, but we haven't got any of the other factors that trigger a bear market. So whether the market falls another 10% or not, or whether we're there or at the bottom now in this little mini correction, that's all it is. It's a correction.
Yes.
And people forget the overall picture. The shares are back where they were 3 months ago, man. Not even a year, 3 months ago.
Well, I mean, it's not a V-shaped recovery, Wayne, but it's a pretty impressive recovery. Because if you have a look at the daily graph from Monday of the S&P 500 futures, the low of the day when people were at their most vulnerable, the S&P went to 5,120. It's now 5,355. That's the September futures. That's a massive move to the upside. But you missed out one thing, one very crucial thing. And I think the emphasis, in my opinion, should be on Japan after many, many years. I think it was since 2007, raising interest rates from 0.1% to 0.25%. And you know that people borrow money in yen and then invest elsewhere. And suddenly, having been so sanguine about it and woken up every morning and saying, keep on borrowing yen, and that's why the yen was...
Just do the carry trade, yeah.
Exactly, do the carry trade, whether it be for capital markets, whether it be for currency trade or equities, whatever. That's what they were doing. And suddenly, their models or their algorithms or whatever it was were completely out of whack. And that was a massive, massive sell-off. I mean, 20% in 3-4 days.
Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah, exactly. To me, that was the trigger. And then, of course, we had the German economic data and the US economic data, including the jobs report, which you've already mentioned. And then there was a little mini contagion in financial financially connected world. So it all came together at the wrong time. So you got one central bank raising, one central bank flattening again, i.e. the US Fed, and a Bank of England cutting. So you got three different outcomes for three massive central banks. And of course, a storm ensued, Wayne.
Mm. But the Japan situation is in fact very different. I mean, they're increasing interest rates, and the stock market collapses because the currency is so strong and they're essentially an exporting nation.
Yes.
And of course, if you're in the carry trade, what you do is you borrow yen, you convert it to another currency, the dollar, whatever, and earn 4% on that. But of course, you've got to pay back your yen loan in yen. And if the yen strengthens, you get flattened.
Mm.
That's also part of what's happened.
Yeah, the yen went from over 160 down into the low 140s. I mean, it's continued on its big long-term trend again. But anyway, it's fascinating stuff. I thought South Africa behaved rather well. When I say South Africa, yes. I mean the JSE. I thought it did rather well. I thought the rand would be in the 19s against the US dollar. I thought the JSE might fall, you know, as a thin, vulnerable emerging market, maybe 3.5%, 4%. But no, it's okay. And look at it today, up over 1%.
Look, the biggest reason why that is our market's not expensive.
Mm.
You know, our market's a long way from expensive. You can argue the industrial index is fair value, but the financials are cheap and the mining shares are just very cheap. So, you know, there's less scope for a collapse if your shares are cheap than what you like. You take the Magnificent Seven or you take NVIDIA or you take Intel. I mean, these shares got properly clobbered. But these are substantial companies with huge cash flows and huge profits. So the only problem they had was the share price had run away from reality, let's call it that. You know, this is not a dot-com. These are not, you know, AI is not a flash in the pan. It's not something that's invented and is going to disappear in three years' time. You won't even hear about AI. So this isn't a classic bubble. It's just the shares got too expensive.
Yes, exactly. It was over exuberance, and it was just what happened on Thursday and Friday in the economically with economic data and also the Bank of Japan, which we've gone into. So people just needed an excuse to get out, and they've probably made large profits, and now suddenly back we go up again because they don't want to miss out on this thing. And it's an impressive bounce back. Not a V-shaped one, but it's fairly impressive, I think.
But look, the share market, the outlook for the share market, and I mean, I've been banging this drum so long now. Mm-hmm. The outlook for the share market, but especially emerging markets, should be quite good over the next 2 or 3 years because you're going into a falling interest rate environment.
Yes.
That is fundamentally good for shares. So, you know, the share market shouldn't tank. So there was just some panic and maybe a bit of the huge excess froth taken out of some shares. But even having said that and low interest rates, companies at high valuations who disappoint on earnings or earnings outlook or anything are still going to get clobbered. They're still expensive despite this correction that we've had. So, and there the classic case was Intel.
Yeah, go on.
I mean, they came out with slightly disappointing results and slightly disappointing outlook. You know, she got clobbered 20% in a day.
That's extraordinary.
It's extraordinary.
For a company that size.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, no matter if falling interest rates is good for the overall market, if you have a highly rated share and you just show a little bit disappointing results or disappointing outlook, your share is still going to get clobbered. And that's why I suppose you come back to the old faithful, you must have a diversified portfolio so, you know, one share doesn't kill you.
Speaking of diversified portfolios, how did your portfolio perform? I mean, you must have turned on your screen on Monday morning with a good deal of trepidation and had a look at the commodity stocks because I know the oil price was very sharply lower. Because it's a sort of a proxy for the world economy. How did, for example, the platinum stocks behave?
I mean, they've just gone down to the lows that we've seen 3 or 4 times this year. You know, so they shot up, and Amplats, maybe the example I know the best, But Amplat shot up to $700 and then went back to 630. You know, it's been sitting at six, it's touched 600 and gone below 600, I think, three times this year. So we didn't hit new lows on the platinum, but clearly they came under pressure.
Yeah.
But at least our portfolios, we'd lightened some of our big global tech exposures. So at least we weren't caught on the downside on that.
And even if you had been caught on the downside, presumably you bought
them at far
favorable levels. And, you know, 5% on NVIDIA really doesn't make that much difference.
Doesn't make much difference.
No, exactly.
No, not when it's gone up 160% in a year.
Exactly. And people should just have a look at the S&P graph and say, well, as you quite rightly said, it's only where it was three, 4 months ago, even at its worst on Monday. And now it's recovering. Yes. It's, what was the high? I think it was on the future, something like 5,720 or something. So, okay, it's a way away from that. But it's thin conditions in the Northern Hemisphere summer. So, I mean, and I think people must contextualize what happened over the last few days, because you can go back and say, go back, say, a year, 18 months on the S&P, and you look at it and you say, and if you'd woken up one morning, having been in a coma for 18 months, and saw the S&P at 5,200, or even 5,120, the low, you'd say, goodness me, look how much it's gone up since I've been asleep. So it's only gone back 3 or 4 months, Wayne.
Yes.
It's a tiny little dot on a long-term graph.
No, correct. I mean, you don't often see really big shares falling 10% in a day. That is unusual.
Yes.
But yes, the correction is, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, you won't even notice it on a monthly chart or a weekly chart in a couple of years' time. But I spoke to another chap that I've known for many, many years, and he was telling me a story that he spoke to. He's our age, so he's old. He was chatting to some young investors, and he was saying, you know, you must watch out for dividends and earnings, and now you must look at cash flows, et cetera, et cetera. This is now, he did this 2 weeks ago, and he said he just got these, you don't know what you're talking about, stares from these young people. And the point of this is that, number one, everyone's a genius in a bull market. Every person's a genius. You know, you just buy the shares that are going up and you make a fortune and you think you know investment. And all of a sudden you get luck in the last 10 days or something. And you realize, hang on, I don't know everything. You know, you don't just buy the shares that are going up. And when you look at longevity in the market, I mean, there's not many people around in investments who are still around in the 90s.
Quite right.
Or even the 2000s. There's not many. And I think that reason is you have a diversified portfolio. You don't put all of your eggs in one basket. And I know another chap that has done spectacularly well, but he runs a geared fund. He runs a hedge fund. So he, every 10 rand of equity that goes in, you know, he borrows 40 against it. Well, not against that 10. He borrows 40 using that 10 as collateral and whatever shares, et cetera, he's buying. And it's wonderful when you're paying, let's say, 10, 12% interest rates and the shares go up 30% in a month, you get massive gearing. But when it collapses on you, it absolutely destroys your net asset value.
Yes.
So, you know, that's why you must be in investments, you must be very careful thinking you're too clever.
And if you've got that sort of gearing
for a long time,
If you've got this sort of gearing as well, I would imagine that fellow or whoever it was that you just described must have some sort of downside protection if it's a long hedge fund or something. You've got to have some put options
in place or whatever.
Hope
so, but you know, put options, look, and it's interesting because options 15 years ago were big. They were big. I don't think the market's as big as what it was, because certainly, we very seldom discuss options, whereas 15 years ago, 20 years ago, look, they were relatively new then, so you discuss them quite often. But I believe options should only be used as an insurance policy.
Precisely.
They should never be used to implement a an actual strategy. So whatever premiums you pay on your options, you must be happy to lose them, because that means your main strategy is actually winning, that you haven't had to cash in on your insurance. But options, to me, the only time you ever use options is heavily out of the money. In other words, you either buy put options well below the current market,
yes,
or you buy call options well above. Because if you buy anything that's close to the money, it's expensive, eh? Not cheap.
No, it's not. But the other thing you have to look at there is the VIX, the volatility index. And I don't know if you saw a graph of the volatility index.
That's gone through the roof.
Through the roof. It went from, I don't know, if it was between 10 and 15, and then went up into the mid-30s, early 40s, something like that. And so options went from being incredibly cheap, being given away, which is when people should have been loading up on puts as an insurance policy. And now, of course, they've become prohibitively expensive because of that VIX spike. Yeah. But anyway, you're okay. Why, just out of interest, you mentioned that you lightened your load a little bit on the tech exposure in your portfolios. Was that simply because they became too big and they went over your mandated limits or something?
So there's no sort of mandate, but you know, if something goes up that strongly, you know, you always take a little bit of money off the table. And of course, we have a central view that the rand's going to strengthen, so we wanted to bring some money back to South Africa. So those are the reasons why we actually lightened our exposures a little bit there. And I mean, I've given quite a few presentations just recently.
Yeah.
And you know, you look at sometimes you call up data, but you don't look at it properly. So obviously, when I was preparing for these presentations, I spent a lot of time getting graphs together and looking at the data, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, at the peak, which I think was $140 a share, NVIDIA as a company had a market capitalization literally within spitting distance of the whole of the UK market's market capitalization.
Yeah, I've heard that statistic. Yes.
90% of the UK was way bigger than France and Germany. You know, that just, when you look at something like that, you just look at it and you just say,
wait a second.
Really? Can this be right? But what we do know is NVIDIA is an absolutely fantastic company that's going to perform incredibly well. Just is 140 the right share price, or is 100 or 110 or 80 the right share price?
Well, of course, there's no such thing as a right share price or a wrong share price. If the market, if it's 120 or 140, yes, whatever it is, that is the right share price, because that's what someone is willing to buy or sell at. So, long term, the moving average.
Let's not say the right share price. Mm. What represents decent value for what? Is at the better expression.
Yeah, that's a much better way to put it. Okay, but anyway, everything's fine. Saying there won't be a few bumps along the road as people expect the Fed to have an interim cut or something like that, or do they wait for September the 18th, the next Fed meeting? We don't know. But it's all fine, because if it weren't all fine, it would have gone, had a next leg down. May still do, but it's okay, it's a wobble. Let's talk about food, Wayne. I want to talk to you about food. I made something called a frittata last night, which I'm very good at. I buy these potatoes that were developed in Germany in the early 1960s. It was a cross between one particular variety and the other. And they're called Nicola potatoes, and they're the ultimate versatile potato. And you boil them, you peel them, you boil them, and you slice them up, mix them in a bowl with, five or six eggs, salt and pepper, as simple as that, in a pan, and it's lovely. And I always make more so that the next day I can have half of it cold, which is even more delicious. That's the first thing. The other thing I've done is investigated something called crowd farming. Have you ever heard of that?
No, never heard of that. No.
Okay, crowd farming is like crowdfunding. What you do is that this cooperative of farmers, it started in Europe and it's very popular in the Netherlands. So say you like oranges, you know, your favorite thing is the orange harvest from Spain because they're so sweet and juicy. What you do is you pay the farmer, the orange farmer, an amount up front, and you own a tree. And so when it's harvest time, they put all the oranges in your tree in two or three boxes and ship them to you. I mean, I don't know how many oranges you can eat a day, but you can juice them and everything like that. It's actually become very, very popular in Europe, where you want tomatoes or broccoli or whatever it is.
So it's almost like timeshare.
Precisely.
And syndication, yeah.
Yeah, if the farmers get money up front, which they need, you know, for hard times and fertilizer and all that stuff, and you get something that's very delicious straight from the farm, and it's actually nice. There's a symbiosis there between customer and farmer.
So yeah, that's when you're becoming a small scale farmer yourself.
Precisely, and I've got a tree in Valencia. Oh no, Seville, sorry, an orange tree. And now I'm going to, because tomatoes are so terrible in this country, I'm going into the tomato business.
Okay, and you're not going to buy a pig or something in Germany?
No, what can I do with a pig? I mean, they'll have to slaughter it for me, obviously. But you can do that. You can get yourself a little piglet or whatever it is. Maybe they slaughter it for you at the abattoir and send you over the proceeds. I don't know, but at the moment I'm sticking to vegetables. So that's my food story. Anything from you?
Yes. Now, last night, the world's biggest actually cooked us some tacos, and she's done that many, many times, one of our favorite meals.
Yes.
And she cooks up a nice spicy mince to go with it, and she gets some sour cream.
Yeah.
And she always adds in salad and, you know, normally coleslaw type crunchy salad. But last night she actually got some black rice.
That's interesting.
A delicious taste, very nutmeg taste, very, very nice taste. And some, I mean, I might get the name wrong, but endomi beans, like a
endomani beans. Endomani beans, yes. Endomani. It's essentially a soybean, yes.
Yeah. And she cooked all of this up and put it with a bit of mayonnaise, and we chucked in some crushed cashew nuts into the sauce and a bit of balsamic vinegar. And we had it on our hard shell crispy tacos with spicy mince, and I must say, it was truly delicious.
And she didn't do.
I've never had those beans before.
No, they're good. If you ever get a takeaway from a Japanese restaurant, those beans are something. They're like pea pods, and you just squeeze the little beans out, and they're very delicious. Mm. I always have that as a starter. So she didn't do a guacamole. She didn't scoop out a couple of avocados and mash it up.
We didn't do that. And, you know, the problem with avos, and I really like avos, is if you go to Willy's or wherever and you buy avos off the rack, they as hard as rocks, even though the sign says ripe. Yes. They're not even close to ripe. They are literally as hard as rocks. You've got to get out your hacksaw to cut them. So you say, oh, I'll leave them for a little while, and then you feel them the next day, and they're still hard, and then you feel them the next day, and they're still hard, and then you feel them the next day, and they're rotten.
Yeah, it's very, very frustrating.
It's astonishing how quickly it actually turns. So we don't actually keep avos, and then you can buy guacamole as a sauce, but we didn't do it last night.
No, don't do that.
A premix.
Yeah. No, you mustn't do that. You must always make your own. If you do get a hard avocado, my tip is as follows. You just take some bog standard newspaper, wrap the thing up individually in newspaper, and put it somewhere where it doesn't matter. It can be a cool, dark place or a light, warm place. And within a day, that thing has ripened. So you just unwrap it and check it every day. But it's the newspaper thing.
I must actually buy some, because sliced avo on toast with a little bit of salt and a little bit of vinegar is truly delicious.
That's what I had this morning, Wayne. But you know what the secret ingredient that I use? I just use pepper, first of all, after I've mashed it onto my toast. Worcestershire sauce, Leon Perrin's Worcestershire sauce. A few drops of that. It's a devastatingly delicious combination.
No, I've never tried it. I mean, I love Worcester sauce. I drown my steak and kidney pies and my sardines on toast. I drown it in Worcester sauce. I love Worcester sauce. If ever I inadvertently come across a stew, which will never happen in our house, but if I go somewhere and someone prepares a stew, as long as they've got enough Worcester sauce, you can make it palatable.
Yeah, you see, that's your mother's legacy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I must admit, the Lee and Perrings is the only one to get. Holbrook's isn't bad, but I bought some other brand, Wellington's Worcester sauce. It was tepid. It was terrible.
Oh, dear.
It had no real taste to it.
Okay, so Lee and Perrins is, yeah, it's a brand name, but yeah. It's the original and best. Okay, Wayne, it's not even 5 o'clock as we pre-record this, but I'm already hungry, so I may have a go and have a sneaky slice of my frittata that's cold in the fridge, just as it's tied me over till dinner. So thank you very much for your time, as always. Wayne McCurry is a portfolio manager at F&B Wealth and Investment in Johannesburg, and that was Wayne on Wednesday. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position, or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer, or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.